Hi, I'm Rob Kendall, and this is the Front End Podcast.
The Front End Podcast explores the ins and outs of life as a developer. We delve into challenging topics around modern day development and technology, including learning, professional growth, programming languages, frameworks, tools, techniques, UX, UI, careers, and so much more. So joining us today is Ben Furphy. Is that pronounced right?
That's right, yeah. Like Murphy with an F.
Murphy with an F. I like it. Yeah, I have to ask because I'd rather pronounce stuff properly. Mine's Kendall, but I always get Campbell or Candle, which could just be me mumbling things over the phone. But anyway, Ben Furphy, in his own words, is a marketing web developer. He's a former games journalist and loves things like Laravel PHP, Vue.js, and Tailwind CSS, which we're going to talk a little bit about today. So Ben, hello.
Hello.
How's everything going? We're in the midst of the corona lockdown. I say a lockdown, no one's ever used that word in the UK, I don't think. It was one of those, you're not locked down like Italy, but don't leave your houses to do anything. How are you getting on with it?
Yeah, not too bad. It's one of those, you know, you just kind of got to get on with it. I've lived in countries where it's that hot during the summer anyway that, you know, you are practically locked down anyway, you know, unless you want to go outside and be absolutely drenched in 5 minutes. So 4 months of the year, you know, you kind of experience not a forced lockdown. So quite used to being in a confined space for quite a while.
Because you're a dev team manager, so how are you finding managing your team if you've had to move to a sort of, like everyone has, like more of a remote situation? I mean, for me, it's fine. I've been a remotey for a year, so like it's literally nothing's really changed for me. It's just watching everyone else kind of coping with it. But how are you getting on managing a team from far away?
Yeah, it's not been too bad. I mean, I've worked on teams that have been remote previously. I think it's been a bit of a more interesting time because we've gone from a development team of two down to a development team of zero. One being nothing to do with the coronavirus. It's just one was on probation and didn't quite work out. And the other one who'd been there for 18 months actually was offered an opportunity he really would have been stupid to turn down. And yeah, kind of just, I sort of said to him, don't turn that down. And he accepted the role. So it ended up being a team of one again, but I'm gonna have the lovely experience of onboarding someone remotely. We've got a developer starting on Monday, so to answer the original question, it's been a learning experience, and I think I've had to experience almost everything of that you'd do as a manager, from, you know, sort of probationary assessment to, you know, sort of having people hand their notice in to having, you know, sort of not enjoyable conversations remotely. And it's been a very weird experience.
I think it's a good sign of a nice manager that, or a good manager, one that kind of is kind of there to build the staff up. And the fact that you said, like, you've encouraged him, look, this is a great opportunity, go for it. You know, that's just like quite good to hear, because I've handed my notice in the past and it's been like an awful experience, mainly at places where anyone who left was basically, they could have just been set on fire and that might have been a better experience for them. And it shouldn't be that way, because, you know, life's life, you get opportunities, and I think that's how you get on in life. They come along every now and again and you just listen out for them and take them. And it's up to, really, I think, managers to be like, it's a real shame if we can do anything to make you stay, great, but if you know, you've got the opportunity, great, you've got to go for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, like, this particular developer, we actually found at a point where he plateaued in the agency he was working in. It was one of these agencies that was moving over to Elementor, did not want to work with that, you know, sort of wanted to work more in an environment where it was, you know, you were actually coding most of the time. So he came in, built his skills up over the 18 months and, you know, sort of left a completely different developer. I think it'd be a fair assessment. And he, you know, the sort of the review that we had from him was absolutely glowing, and you know, sort of was a vindication of the approach that I tried to take, which is, you know, you can't ever hold people on, because at the end of the day, especially at the moment, it's a developer's market. So you've just got to try and make sure that you do the best for them and hope that as long as the job stays aligned with what they're wanting to do, they'll stay. And if not, then there's no point in trying to keep somebody who obviously doesn't want to be there.
No, and I think that's important. You know, I think I do a lot of mentoring and stuff, and I think one of the best bits of career advice is kind of listening to your own self. A bit like when they say when you do weightlifting, you know, kind of listen to your own body and it'll tell you kind of what it needs, or when you've pushed it a bit too far. And I think when it comes to your career, you've got to listen to the signs internally. Like, if you feel like you're just coasting and not really growing or learning anything, or there's no opportunities to do that. Or even I've found you end up like the big fish in the little pond, which feels good for a little while, but then you kind of go, yeah, but I need a bigger fish to kind of pull me along a little bit.
Oh yeah. And I mean, the thing is, you can easily end up in a situation where, you know, you've been somewhere for 10, 15 years and realistically you should have moved on a long time ago to learn, you know, whatever new skills and new techniques. And that's not something that's unique to development. That can happen in design, it can happen in content, it can happen anywhere. And the fact is that he was at a critical juncture in his career where, you know, he needs to get out there and get different experience if he's going to continue developing as a developer. So would have preferred if he stayed, but you know, at the end of the day, it was an amazing opportunity for him. I've been there in the past. There's no way I could have said don't, or it's a bad idea, because I'd have been being hypocritical if I said that.
Now I see from a little bit of a potted stalkerish LinkedIn scan that you've worked for all your dev manager now with IMI Mobile. You have worked for popular tech magazine T3, very exciting.
Yep.
And in exotic locations such as the Middle East in Dubai as a marketing manager. How did you get from the kind of media and journalism side into the kind of web development and web management end of things?
So I'd actually started off on that side. I had a bit of a weird experience of how I got into it. When I was younger, I was absolutely obsessed with SimCity. I kind of absolutely loved physical geography, loved human geography, and wanted to go into the very, very sexy industry of town and country planning. you know, not really something that you think a 14 or 15 year old be looking at, but you know, I absolutely loved, you know, sort of playing SimCity and was fascinated by that type of stuff. So as you do in the UK, started getting ready to do work experience, applied to the local council, all got it lined up to go and do 2 weeks in their planning department. Then about 3 weeks before it was due to start, got a letter basically saying that they were having to retract the offer due to a major project starting that they couldn't have anyone from outside the department on. And while they never told me what it was, I am absolutely convinced it was the Mersey Gateway. Obviously, being 3 weeks out from doing work experience, when you kind of need to plan that months in advance if you want to get anywhere decent, I didn't really want to end up falling in with the sort of kids who couldn't be bothered. But luckily, another one of the departments in the council offered me a place, which was the IT team. And I ended up spending my 2 weeks basically learning HTML, CSS, and building or at least contributing to the council site, which is where I ended up getting into development in the first place. And then kind of actually started, as you do when you're a teenager, getting obsessed with other things, and suddenly spoke to someone when I was doing my sort of GCSE A-levels who suggested that, you know, I should, you know, look at doing something with my writing. And being someone who enjoyed playing video games, the idea of, well, I could play video games and write about them and be paid for it came about. And so I kind of pivoted from wanting to do town and country planning and ended up going to university and doing media with the sort of goal of becoming a video games journalist, which I eventually did. I say it like that as if like it just happened. One person who I respect massively, a guy called Dan Grillopopoulos, said, there are fewer games journalists than there are MPs, but there are a lot of people who want to become one. It's kind of, I was very fortunate to end up fulfilling that dream. But worked there for a couple of years, ended up getting an opportunity to move to an IT magazine where I could utilize my knowledge of web development, and kind of fell in that way. Ended up doing that for a couple of years and then got headhunted to go over to work for a magazine group in the Middle East, which is how I ended up in Dubai. So did that for 2 years and then ended up having an experience which was not particularly pleasant. Won't go into it on the record because I'm still not 100% sure whether there could be ramifications, but that kind of made me think, I really don't want to be in the media anymore, certainly not in the media over there anyway. So I was offered a job as a marketing manager and to do a bit of stuff on an IT resellers website who I knew through my time working for the magazines. So went and did that for a couple of years. And then unfortunately, my dad passed away. So I ended up moving back to the UK, which is how I ended up doing stuff for T3. My former editor from when I was working in the UK was actually the editor of T3 at the time. So I ended up basically having a chat with him and got took on as their sort of news journalist, where I'd basically, my job was to go around and try and find the stories that they hadn't covered and just basically write those stories up and get them onto the website. So they were at least covering everything. I only had to produce 8 of those stories a day. And being an experienced journalist, man, I could turn them around in 2-3 hours. I kind of had a lot of spare time on my hands. So I started sort of delving back into web development at that point. So that's kind of how I got back into it and ended up setting up my own agency, working on that for a while, joining another agency in Warrington as one of their sort of senior front-end devs. Did that for a little while. And then, yeah, kind of went between a couple of agencies, couple of in-house roles until I ended up at IMI.
I love the games journalism thing. You know, I actually wanted to go into that. I wanted to get into games. I was the same from being like 3 or 4. I mean, this was like the golden age of the games in the 80s, where it was like Mega Drives and kind of SNESes and things, and the NES, and it was brilliant. And I wanted to get into games journalism as well. I used to read all the PC Zone was the one I got quite regularly. Back when floppy disks were an actual real thing, not just a little save icon. You used to get a floppy disk like just glued to the front of it every week, and it was like, oh, what the hell did they have on there? So like Double Dragon and these crazy Colin McRae rally stuff, like, oh yeah, you get the demo. Brilliant. Don't have any of that nowadays. It just, it loses something when it's like online or just a YouTube video.
Yeah, I mean, there are some amazing stories that I know of from that sort of era of games. One of the more infamous ones being Charlie Brooker's stint on PC Zone. So I don't know whether you are aware of what happened with that.
With
have you ever heard about, yeah, Charlie Brooker and PC Zone? It's an amazing story.
Is it? No, he suddenly came out of nowhere. I don't particularly like him. I liked his writing, but like seeing him in the Channel 4 shows and stuff he's done, he comes off like a bit of a prick, I'm going to be honest. But like he was in PC Zone suddenly, and then he kind of used to do these weird columns, and then he kind of just wasn't anymore. So yeah, what was that about?
They used to do a cartoon. They used to basically point fun at various things, and they decided to point fun at the fact that there'd been criticism of the original Tomb Raider that it was a bit of a, you know, sort of a wild animal hunting simulator. And so they created Herman Mutz's Cruelty Zoo, which basically was a cartoon about people being able to go around and shoot exotic animals in the face. And basically, Eidos caught wind of this, the publisher of the original Tomb Raider, and basically told them that if they published it, they'd basically be sued, from what I understood, which resulted the entire PC Zone staff ending up sitting in the London office, basically with Stanley Knives cutting that page out of 70,000 copies of magazines before they went to the shop, because it had already gone to print. So yeah, just a little bit of video games trivia there. But it was a very interesting job. It was very poorly paid as well. Unfortunately, when you've got many people who are willing to do that job, you know, for free, effectively, it does kind of depress the salary, no matter how talented you are. Yeah, no, it was definitely a really fun experience, but it's one of those things. I remember speaking to people beforehand, and they were like, "Don't go into testing. It's not, you know, what you think it is." Funnily enough, video game development never interested me. I think it was always missold as like math heavy, and while I was good at math, I didn't really enjoy it. Yeah, it kind of never really occurred to me as a career option, so I ended up going down the route of least resistance from a skills perspective.
People do. They tell you that it's very maths heavy, and I think it probably is, to be fair. But I, my work experience I did at BT in Middlesbrough, where I'm from, and randomly they had some chap there, and I don't know how he ended up there, but he was the original UK programmer of Tetris, I think he said. Like, he'd kind of potted it over or done something, but it was kind of amazing. I was like, what are you doing here, dude? And I recognized him from, because he was featured in something like Edge or PC Zone or something. I was like, oh my God, it's you. And I got chatting with him. Obviously, I was very interested. And yeah, he was very much like, I would do, if you're going to go into video games, do like a maths degree. And as it turned out, like, university just wasn't the route for me. And at that time, we didn't have the resources now. And learning something like C++, which is a phenomenally difficult language, it wasn't just, let's go and watch some YouTubes or some lovely Udemy courses. It was like, here's a book that's bigger than a small child.
I don't think you could really describe even a Udemy course on C++ as lovely. It's more of sort of like a sort of coding equivalent of sadomasochism.
Yeah, if you can survive this course. I think I got as far as the old import the stdio.h file and then like print.
Standard out and stuff,
Dance by GN and standard out and print your name. And then it was like, oh, this is great. Now, how do I get from this to like Doom? And you're like, I have no idea.
I got a bit further than that, but I kind of got to the point where you were starting to have to do memory management. I was like, no, I really don't want to do this. This is not what I want to do.
Yeah, I had the same experience with guitar. I heard Guns N' Roses at 14. I was just like, yes, mate, I want to learn that. How do I get from not even knowing how to hold a guitar to like Slash? And it seemed that the route started with sort of, let's learn Michael Roy, you bought Sean, single notes on the E string. And I was like, yeah, this isn't going to do it. And I found a good guitar teacher that helped me kind of get up there where he went, oh, well, we'll teach you a Guns N' Roses song and the theory behind it. And I think it's a similar kind of thing. There's a lot of crap to do with, you know, something like C++ or C before you even get to like the games bit, like you said, memory management and stuff that us cushy JavaScript devs, we just take for granted because the browser just handles all that for you.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good explanation as to why, sort of JavaScript has become the language du jour of development, really. I think it's quite an easy language to pick up. I mean, like anything, it's an easy language to pick up, but an incredibly difficult language to master. I think PHP many, many years ago was that language, and it certainly was that language around the time that I started getting into development. It's one of those where I think that's kind of been one of the biggest game changers is not having to work with those low-level languages that were pretty much not the only option, but the main option for you back in those days.
Dev managers, I find, tend to be sort of fairly binary. They're either kind of like more like tech leads where they're kind of like, I'm doing the code, but I'm also like looking after people, or they're just completely removed and like they just sort of do the management. So do you get to do some of the code still? Or?
Yeah, I'd say that probably about 50% of my job is still code-based, even if it literally could, some weeks just comes down to just being the person doing the code reviews. It's still very much a role where I'm required to have a very hands-on role, mainly because, although, you know, obviously I've got a very good team around me, you know, from a technical perspective, I am the, you know, sort of person who people come to, you know, if my manager, who's the head of digital, can't answer the question, you know, if I don't understand it, then, you know, I can't really say yes or no. And there are certain things to do with, you know, sort of very data sensitive systems, such as the CRMs and stuff, that typically only I would ever end up dealing with, just because of data sensitivities and, you know, sort of the importance of making sure that it is done properly and that we don't screw anything up, because otherwise it's my neck on the line.
Oh yeah, and the old GDPR nightmare.
Yes,
Do you have I presume, given that you quite like the Laravel and the framework for PHP and things, do you find you kind of split between back end and front end? And I'll point out that PHP, it's definitely not a front end language, despite what recruiters will tell you. The amount of recruiters I've had going, you'd be great, I've got this great front end role, something, something, PHP. And I'm like, well, there's two problems with that. One, it ain't front end, and there's nowhere that I've ever touched PHP, apart from maybe a bit of WordPress fiddling. But I mean, that's kind of like, you know, changing the battery in your car and saying, oh, I'm a mechanic. So do you find your kind of split between the two of those, like a bit mixture of front and back? Do you have a preference?
I'd say that I'm probably stronger front end, and that's just sort of down to the roles that I've had primarily, but I've always been full stack, mainly because I think there's definitely something to be gained from having a holistic view of how data is sort of input, but then also how it's handled, and, you know, sort of understanding from a business perspective where that data goes. I always find it helps a lot in terms of being able to communicate between the designers, the actual business people in the company, and also the end user effectively, and try and make sure that everything works for all three stakeholders effectively within within that sort of triumphant whatever three a group of three people is. I can't think of what the word
trifecta?
Is. Trifecta, that's it, yes. Within that that trifecta. Like I said, I try to work between them. I like systems that have a clear delineation between front and back end. Things like Twig or, you know, templating languages like or engines like Twig or Blade or, you know, in the .NET community, Razor, are great examples of how to make sure that you can separate those two areas without, you know, sort of handicapping anyone. Obviously, they're very much MVC. I always find that those type of things mean that you can either, rather than having to worry about context switching, which I always find is a massive problem whenever I'm working with a WordPress code base, where you're trying to switch between, right, I need to do something in PHP now, I'm going to do something in front-end, you know, code now, what do I need to pass through, what do I need to bear in mind, where are the security things? With that kind of separation, it kind of makes it a lot easier for you to focus on what you're doing at that point.
I like what you said about the, you know, having an understanding of different areas. Because I think I shared the article on Twitter the other day, and I think you'd commented on it about is front-end development dead? Or the term front-end developer, is that dead? And it's quite a bold statement. It wasn't mine. It was just an interesting article. I think there is this rise of this kind of polyglot, I think the term is, this kind of, not so much a jack-of-all-trades developer, but, you know, you've got to be a bit more, you've got to have your horizons broadened a bit beyond just like, well, I just like the CSS part, or I'm just JavaScript. You know, people like to be, oh, I'm front-end developer, but like literally they're just JavaScripty. You know, you need to understand how to kind of talk to people about the UI and the UX of it, because ultimately what you're building is, you know, for the user, right?
I think even beyond that, there's actually a flawed definition these days between what we traditionally think of as a front-end developer and what we think of as a back-end developer, in the sense that if you went back, you know, obviously if you went back 20 years when we both first started coding, there was no definition. You were just a developer. And then as things went on, you kind of got this delineation between the two roles, where front-end was HTML, CSS, and behavioral JavaScript, and back-end was very much your sort of data management, how are you collecting stuff, how are you sanitizing things, how are you mutating data, how are you, you know, sort of manipulating that and passing it between the data store and the front end templates. And what I think we found is that as time has gone on and as you get more sort of frameworks like React and Vue and Angular, that kind of delineation has become blurred, because a lot of the stuff that people say is front-end is actually what we would always have traditionally called back-end, but just on the client side. So I think it's that kind of, there's definitely an issue with the naming of those roles, where I think we need to be very careful about how we are sort of defining that role and saying, you know, do we have UI developers, but someone who is just a HTML, CSS, and a little bit of JavaScript? Do we have it as front end? Do we have it, you know, sort of get rid of those names altogether and go client side or, you know, server side? I don't know. It's one of those things that I don't think any one person is going to be able to answer. You know, the traditional sort of separation of roles, I think, doesn't really work anymore because of that change in the way that the ecosystems work.
It's almost as if it's become more sort of client-focused developers. So if you're or user focused, if you like. So if you're building things that are dealing with the user, or you're building stuff that's really more for a developer, like an API, for instance, is not, you know, user based. No user's going to use that. And I don't mean the case where people consume an API, but generally me as a user using some software, you know, I'm not going to touch that. So if you are building an API that, you know, an internal one, that would likely be to serve another developer who's maybe serving a client. So it's almost like, you know, user based developer. It doesn't sound as it's got as cool as front end though.
No, I think that's the thing, is I think there needs to be some kind of name that kind of fits that particular role. As much as we rely on recruiters, I think, like you said before, they some of the worst ones can muddle the situation, where they call, you know, a front-end job a back-end job, or, you know, call a back-end job a front-end job, and kind of confuse the nomenclature. I mean, we always point and laugh at the whole Java and JavaScript confusion, but, you know, at the end of the day, that kind of is something that we need to look at as an industry and try and come to at least some kind of agreement of what those type of roles should be called.
Now, we're here to talk about CSS because we've had people talking about linting and code analysis, and JavaScript gets a lot of love, and rightly so, but, you know, not a bit too much, probably. But I don't think there's enough chatter about CSS. So we're here to sort of rectify that. Now, you're a big lover of Tailwind CSS. So perhaps you can tell us a bit about Tailwind and why you love it.
Yeah, so Tailwind is what is known as utility CSS. A great way of sort of describing it is maybe, touching on the three types of CSS or ways of styling, I suppose. So you've got the way that I originally learned how to build websites, which was inline styles. And if you've ever typed style equals whatever, you know, you've written an inline style, or if you want to go really far back, things like font and BG color and stuff that were written inline and sort of defined as their own properties, if you want to go really far back. That's one way of doing it. The problem with that is obviously that you don't have any access to things like media queries or, you know, sort of state interaction styles. We kind of then had this general movement towards inline bad, or, you know, sort of declarative bad, in that we should really be using semantic class names. So the class name should describe what they do. You know, and that's where we kind of ended up with the sort of Bootstrap foundation names, where, you know, we basically call a button class and then hook on several different properties to that particular class name. And then you, within that, you've got five or six different methodologies for how to name them. And then you've got functional CSS, which is, or utility CSS, which is more the idea of saying what it does. So in its most pure form, which Tailwind, you know, sort of follows, it's the idea that one class should define or should be used for one particular outcome of a property and a value. Whereas, you know, like I was saying before, a button in regular CSS or semantic CSS might have, you know, a display of block, a padding of, let's say, 12 top and bottom and 16 left and right. And, you know, it might be set to be font bold, you know, font weight bold, and, you know, text white and background color blue. Let's just say that. In functional CSS like Tailwind, each of those properties and values has its own class name. So you end up writing out a lot more classes into the HTML, but the idea with that is that it becomes a lot more maintainable. Now, this is a big point of contention in the community at the moment, because it is a very big paradigm shift. But we've been using it in production now for 2.5 years, Tailwind, when it was still in beta. And I would say that the experience that we've had with it is that it is infinitely easier to maintain websites that use it. They are, on the whole, a lot leaner and a lot easier to maintain. And they also don't suffer with the same issues that a lot of semantic websites, semantic CSS-based websites suffer from, you know, such as bloat and specificity battles and that sort of thing.
There's some really great benefits. When I first saw it, I was a little bit turned off to it. Because, you know, sometimes when you go, oh, I'll have a look at this, but like you just sort of scan through something, and if it doesn't take you straight away, and I looked at it, and I'd gone down the route of kind of SAS and the BEM methodology and stuff, and so I was coming at it from that angle, and I looked at Tailwind, and I was just like, well, this just looks like,
oh gosh, revolting,
looks like some kind of blunderbuss. Someone's took a blunderbuss loaded with class names and just gone, here, HTML, take that in the face.
Do you know what it looks like? Have you ever looked at what like Squarespace and that and Wix put out in terms of CSS classes? Like that. Yeah. It looks like that, like, you know, this random mix of characters. And I think if it hadn't been for the fact that before I joined IMI, I worked on a contract, which I would be lying if I said it went well. Basically, I was brought in to help refactor the front end and to help them rebuild their application. It really didn't go well. When I got in there, the CSS framework, which was BEM based, and it was too clever for its own good. It was incredibly obtuse. It was very, very difficult for people to be onboarded onto. And I ended up sort of explaining this and saying, look, we have to rewrite this. And the time that I was there, we ended up, you know, sort of trying to get it rewritten and, you know, at least in line with BEM standards. And we just kept butting into the same issues time and time again in terms of bloat or repetition of classes and that type of thing. And obviously, BEM teaches you a lot of very, very good practices when it comes to CSS. You know, the idea that your selectors should be flat, that from a performance perspective, if you are going to have something like a button and your modifier, let's say, can define size, i.e. you might have one that's called button hyphen hyphen small and button hyphen hyphen large, that you should not define anything that is defined by that modifier in the base class. So you are not overwriting that property and one, adding extra lines of code to the code base, which isn't needed, but also then increasing the time it takes to process that document. And obviously we're talking about a minor amount of time, but you know, in certain situations, every process counts. So there's a lot of things it teaches, but then there are a lot of things that are very obtuse with it, which are, you know, sort of the rules that say you cannot call your blocks or elements anything to do with what they look like. They have to describe what they are there to represent. So you can't have a modifier which says button padding top 12 or whatever, which means that if you have many classes that are very similar, so you could have, for example, a card. Almost every single website or application uses a card, but you might have an article card, or you might have a product card, or you might have a task card, or a various different types of cards. Technically, under BEM, you're meant to have a different class for each of those. And if you're having modifiers that are doing exactly the same thing, and then you're having elements that are doing exactly the same thing, you end up with this monumental amount of bloat in the code base, which is absolutely unnecessary, and is only there because of the convention rules that BEM kind of places on you when you're working with it. Over the time that I was there, you know, I was kind of running up against this frustration constantly. I was moving more towards an idea of using block element utility. So, you know, using the block and the element part of BEM, but then just ditching the modifier and just using utility classes to provide that kind of functionality. So, you know, if we were adding padding 12 to something, we weren't having to define it 15 times across the entire code base and then remember every time that we needed to change something that we had to put it out. Or, you know, if we were being clever and we were using, you know, sass variables, and you had to kind of remember where to change them, and, you know, you've then got all kinds of horrific visual regression problems that you've then got to go and double check. It's not enjoyable, and it's not really maintainable over the long term.
And I think more people could have that attitude, you know, that take something and adapt it. There's no police going to come and sort of the BEM police aren't there going, oh, we've got on, boys.
No, but the Twitter police might. How dare you
take something I've gatekeeped? And the weird thing is, people don't do it in real life. Like, you wouldn't buy a knife and go, wow, I don't know, it doesn't say I can cut rope with it. So, I mean, you know, the rules say you've only got to cut these three specific things. You know, you just sort of go, well, it's a knife, I'm going to cut stuff.
No, exactly, yeah.
And yeah, with things like programming, like, well, no, the solid rules say this. Like, yeah, and?
Yeah. They're meant to be more there as a baseline. They're not necessarily meant to be there as a, you know, a hard and fast rule. Because at the end of the day, if you look at it, Uncle Bob was not the first person to come up with these rules. But, you know, he kind of adapted what he'd learned and, you know, sort of codified them. You know, so they're not all original ideas. They were things that existed before he kind of started pitching them. And, you know, that's the thing. I think sometimes, you know, you need to sort of remember that you can't be too stuck in your way. I think that was kind of when I left that contract and I joined IMI, you know, I kind of really didn't want to work with BEM. And then one of the code bases I came into was, I'm going to describe it as BEM-like, in that it broke the cardinal rule of don't have grandchildren elements. And yeah, kind of, I could see where they were going with it, but I think that's another downfall of BEM, is that it requires quite a lot of understanding for you to be able to do it properly. Whereas utility classes are much easier to understand. You know, the reality is, I always use the example of a button when we're talking about this. Yes, a button is a button is a button, but a button can look a million different ways depending on the application. So you coming in might understand that that's a button, but you don't know how that button's constructed. You don't know what the modifiers or the variables or the different conditions on that button are. You could have somebody who's been stupid and has a chain selector which says article button as a button class, you know, And all of a sudden, like, you're then wondering why the hell something isn't behaving, or you're getting these random classes and you suddenly realize that they've chained the specificity too high. And that kind of, like, really pours scorn on that whole idea of, you know, semantic CSS is the easiest way of onboarding people. If you go to any website that is using that type of thing, you'll see that the button is defined as something like block, or, you know, it might be like flex potentially if you're making it possible to have icons in there. And then, you know, it might have padding Y of 3, PX4, font bold, text white, background blue, focus blue 700, hover focus blue 700, that type of thing. And it's that type of thing of, well, yes, you kind of do need to know what it's saying. Once you've worked on one website that uses Tailwind, you can go into any website and you know exactly how that website works. And that's because there's a paradigm shift from it being descriptive of what the element looks like to descriptive of how it looks. Not what it looks like, but how it looks. So the actual hard definition. And it's that kind of mentality of using the classes as a wrapper, like an API interface, like a really low-level API interface to, you know, effectively style things in a way that is a little bit more intuitive to people who've done it once or twice.
Yeah, and I like that sort of descriptive nature about it. When I actually got into it, I'm doing it for a little side, using it for a bit of a side project, and I think the learning curve is a bit steeper because you've got to kind of apply like 5-6 different classes to.
Yeah, you're unlearning 20 years of, in some ways, propaganda from those people who espouse that we should use semantic CSS. And, you know, let's be absolutely clear here. You know, there's plenty of propaganda that goes on around about utility classes. I'm sure there'll be something that'll come along that'll probably be better than that in however long, you know, and it won't be CSS and JS. So we'll not hear people trying to claim that that is the one and true savior. It's not. But it's one of those things where I think the difficulty more often than not is just it's that mental leap between how we've done it and how we've been told for the last 20 years not to write CSS like this. And I think the other thing as well is, and I know you've seen this objection on Twitter as well, is for a lot of people, they kind of think, and it seems to be a developer of a particular, not age, because age is the wrong way of describing it, but someone who's been around long enough to have experienced the first type of way that you built a website with inline styles, knowing the pain of trying to update a website that's built that way. And it is, you can write Tailwind completely the wrong way by building a whole website with no partials and no kind of templating engine or anything like that. Yeah, and it's that type of thing of you have to effectively try and work out a way of utilizing things like templating engines to make it easier for you to effectively manage that website code base a little bit more efficiently than, you know, how you would if you were going to go down the route of completely building out something on a single HTML document.
No, absolutely. And that's a good follow-up question, actually. It's like, I'm a React person, you like Vue, but I mean, essentially they both offer this kind of idea of component modular driven development. So how do you avoid using something like Tailwind and ending up with a kind of the kind of class soup situation that we talked about? Do you create kind of reusable modules with it rather than having to kind of, like, I suppose, reinvent the wheel each time? So if you want to, every time you use a button, you know, you've got to like apply a bunch of different classes. Do you kind of pull those out into the Tailwind config, or do you actually kind of apply them at the Vue module, if you like, Vue component level?
So obviously it depends entirely on what I'm building. If I'm building it in Statamic has its concept of partials, you know, so does Twig. You know, I guess in Vue or JSLand, it would be a, you know, single component. And effectively what I typically do is I break it down into the lowest level components that we might be using when I start a new project. So we will build a title component, and we will build a button component, and we will build a heading component. Those three elements are typically the ones that, you know, you are using over and over and over again. We might even build like an image component if we're going to be utilizing things like the picture element and source set variables and that type of thing. And what we typically try to do is have that very low level component where in the markup, we will define those base settings. So, you know, we might have you know, slots or variables that we can pass through that define the H level, you know, the heading level, if it's a heading that we're talking about, you know, in addition to things like, are we going for, you know, the size or, you know, the various different bits and pieces. Typically what I tend to do is I will have a slot or, you know, a variable within that, that I just pass classes into. So there might be base styles that every single heading will have, i.e. if I know that every heading on a website is font bold, there's no need to redefine that every single time. So I'll just have that in the standard setting. If I know that some are semi-bold, some are light, some are bold, then I'll typically pass that Tailwind class into the component and output it through the slot. When you do that, what you find is that if you need to change every button, then you've only got to find those elements of where they've been defined once, if you've done it right. I mean, realistically, I'd always argue that you shouldn't really be changing things like buttons and stuff anyway when you're getting into code. And this is what the flaw in the whole mentality of design in the browser is, especially for a company like us where, you know, there's so much sign-off that has to happen and so many different people involved. You cannot do it in the browser. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of how we tackle that, and how I would tackle that is, you know, making use of those components to pass things through, define the standards, and then only really pass through the ones that you actually need to manipulate on a component basis.
I like that. I'm going to take that away and yeah, plug it into my own Tailwind usage. I definitely recommend people go and check it out. I was not a fan. I was put off from the start, but I've got into it, and actually I'm coming around to like really liking it, to the point where I wish I'd used it in the stuff we're doing at work rather than going down the kind of Bulma route. I mean, Bulma's quite simple and it's not super bloated, and I've not had to write much extra CSS on top of it, so that's quite nice. But I definitely have a look at it. It's tailwindcss.com. Do you know, I could sit here and talk for another 5 hours about sort of CSS and things.
Oh yeah,
I might have to do a part two, but I think I'm going to wrap things up neatly in a bow, since we've come to that nice conclusive point. Do you have anything you'd like to plug, any links to share, any kind of projects to kind of you want to shout out to?
Not really. I mean, not for my own thing. And to be honest, it's one of those things that always weird, feels weird shouting out your employer when, you know, the type of companies it's targets are, you know, your major banks and telecoms companies and that sort of thing. So I highly doubt we're going to get a lead from this, unfortunately. But if you are interested in Tailwind, if you do want to find out any more, what I would highly recommend is looking at Adam Wavin and Steve Shoger's stuff. Adam Wavin is the guy who is behind Tailwind, and he also works very closely with a designer called Steve Shoger, and they basically produced Refactoring UI, which takes a lot of the principles that are behind the configuration settings of Tailwind and sort of applies that. But then I'd also strongly recommend looking at Tailwind UI as well for a practical application of Tailwind.
And yeah, and I agree. It's really, the documentation's really ace. And for me personally, a lot of clever stuff lives and dies by the documentation. And I've seen some clever stuff, and if it's not documented, I've seen things on GitHub where, like, this looks like it might be a silver bullet to things, but you're like, if I have to go and rummage through your code to work out how to get it to work, I might as well just take a stab at writing it myself.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, like, you know, you get to a certain point and the best documentation is always the code base, but you have to be a certain level of developer to be able to pull that off. But yeah, I mean, you know, on that point, you know, when you go to the Tailwind CSS website, pay attention to that GIF at the top. You know, it's a great visual representation of how to change things based on the different classes and you know, hopefully, I know I've seen a lot of people who have, it's been that's made it click.
Awesome, thank you. Yeah, so check Tailwind out. I'll stick the links to these things. I'll get them off Ben. I'll stick them in the show notes and the transcripts and stuff. Give Ben a follow on Twitter. I think, are you just Ben, at Ben Furphy?
No, I used to many years ago. No, it's Front End Ben. So like Front End Developer, but Front End Ben.
Front End Ben. I love that. Excellent. Give him a follow. Ben, thank you very much for coming. I think we'll definitely have you on for another kind of CSS part two.
Okay, awesome. I'll be happy, yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So that's it for this episode. Do consider subscribing and give us a like or a share on social media. Speaking of which, if you'd like to follow the show, we're available on Twitter at Frontend Podcast. You can follow me, Rob Kendall, on Twitter too at Kendall Mint Code. If you'd like to find out more about the show, sponsor an episode, or be a guest, you can find out more on the dedicated website, thefrontendpodcast.site.